Welcome back to ID the Future. I'm Todd Butterfield, and returning to the podcast is Brendan Dixon, Principal Software Engineer at Microsoft. Last time we talked about two articles on artificial intelligence that you wrote this year, and one was about the brain being compared to a meat computer, and the other about the ramifications, or the lack thereof, of the Watson computer that competed on Jeopardy. Welcome back, and thank you for joining us, Brendan.
Thank you, Todd. Glad to be back.
More recently, August 2nd, you had an article that came out on evolutionnews.org titled Artificial Intelligence and Its Limits. And right at the get-go, I was intrigued by the photo at the top of the article. I thought, what in the world is that? And then I found out it was time-lapse shot of one of those floor-cleaning droids that I've always wished I could have at our house just to make things go a little easier. The pattern in that photo looks a little crazy, but it looks like it got the job done. And thankfully, it looks like the only decision that thing seems to have to make is turn and go and vacuum. And so where will things go from there is what I asked myself. So I was fascinated by the direction you took in this article when you shared that Google officials published a blog backed by a research paper about AI safety. What exactly was their purpose? What's your take on that?
Well, I think there's been some rumblings in the whole AI community. We've had a number of successes over the last couple of years, dating back, actually more than a couple of years now, dating back to Watson's success on Jeopardy a few years ago. And dear Google launched a machine that was able to do a much better job of object recognition and images, things like that. So out of that, you had a few folks, Elon Musk being one of those, who began worrying about, are we on the verge of a Terminator? And I think what I see Google doing is taking a giant breath and saying, well, you know, wait a minute. AI is interesting. It is emerging. What are the kind of problems that we want to prevent? And they broke out five interesting areas for guiding their research.
Well, I'm glad they did. And I found them kind of humorous, if not frightening at the same time, like avoiding negative side effects. And the example was, you don't want it to do something different just to make its job easier. It was amusing, and we don't have to go into the details of all of their points, but I guess your take is it's just exciting that someone as big as Google is trying to help everybody take a breath, as you say, and be careful.
Yeah, I think so, Todd. I think I was both encouraged and I guess a little bit discouraged. I was encouraged that they weren't pouncing on the Terminator wave. I was discouraged in that I still think in some sense that they're missing some big issues that autonomous machines, machines allowed to run on their own without necessarily human oversight, some of the issues that could occur with those kinds of machines. Google and many others are driven by a desire to have machines that actually kind of replace humans. Whereas I'm always an advocate for machines that work alongside humans. I think that's a much safer, much better way to go.
So do you think that there is probably going to be this new job out there where people become advisors in a, I'm not even sure what the term I'm looking for, but they just want to help people think ethically about the work they're planning to do. Do you think that's coming up as a career?
There are people who are adopting those roles now and asking, you know, what are the ethics that we need to be thinking about with computers? You know, you go back to Asimov and his book, iRobot. You know, he in that book propounded, you know, the three laws of robotics, which were supposed to guide, you know, make sure that robots didn't do bad things. But again, the whole thing here is driven by this belief that in building robots, we're creating potentially another sentient life form, just one that's built in silicon instead of in the biological material of which we're made. But and, you know, it's a great, wonderful fantasy story, but I think it just skips over some very evident problems that we have with these machines right now that should give us pause. I had an example in the article that is at least a good parable, if not actually a great example, the kinds of things I get concerned about. And that was the Dow flash crash from a few years ago.
Right.
Now, that was in part caused by a trader in England who was recently arrested. But what happened is he set up a situation in the market such that the high-frequency trading computers, which are statistically based machines, really went off the rails and caused the market to drop 1,000 points until all the safeguards kind of kicked in and brought everything to a halt. What's interesting about that is that's exactly what a computer will do. Computers do really well in the area that they are designed to do well in. But if they hit a boundary, if they hit what I call an edge, if they hit a situation that really is wholly unexpected, machines do not, in most cases, fail gracefully. They fall off a deep, long cliff, crash and burn. And when money or people and lives are on the line, you know, that gets scary. It just gets scary.
It certainly does. So you referred to artificially intelligent machines not having to be required, and maybe they shouldn't be required to work autonomously. And why does that distinction matter then? It's, you've alluded to it already. And in the case of the crash, should there have been or would there be in the future people connected to these automatic responses that are built in?
Yeah, I think so. Let me kind of give you a great example. We can contrast the two cases. You know, imagine you've got a cancer patient in the hospital and the patient's state is being monitored solely by a machine, which is, quote unquote, making decisions about drug delivery and so forth and so on. Counter that case against a situation where, again, the machine is monitoring the patient's status, but instead of the machine directly controlling the administration of drugs, the machine is making recommendations to qualified medical personnel who then administer the drugs, or at least give an approval to administer those drugs. And that, to me, is the difference.
That's a much safer scenario in my mind, thinking of myself someday in a hospital and not wanting to have dependency on this thing to give me an injection at the wrong time or whatever. But giving advice, whole different story.
Well, the part of the problem is in the tech community, and I see a lot of this as being grounded in the neo-Darwinian myth of how we were created. There is this belief that, you know, we're this hodgepodge machine that's been thrown together, and so building another machine that is superior to it, yeah, it really isn't that big of a deal. We're going to succeed at it. And so there's this diminishment of what we are. They over-magnify what they believe their machines can do.
I see.
And so they're eager to replace humans with machines. Myself, all the evidence that I see suggests that we don't really fully understand what we are yet, and we're certainly pretty awe-inspiring. And
yes,
we have our weaknesses, and that's fine. We've always been tool makers that create tools to augment our weaknesses or strengthen us in areas where we don't do as well. That's fine. But that's a whole different world than replacing us. I think that replacement with a toy machine is going to be scary.
Very well put. The way you describe the neo-Darwinists, mm-hmm, thinking that man is just this limited thing, so we can make something else with our own intelligence and make it do even more. And I appreciate that you brought that out just now. On a slightly different tactic, in the article, you mentioned bias in programming. Does that make a difference?
Oh, absolutely. Terribly. And this is something else that we have been, I don't know if it's willful ignorance or just unaware ignorance of. I mean, I've written hundreds of thousands of lines, literally, of computer code to do all kinds of things. And that process entails that I make a correspondingly large number of decisions. Every single one of those decisions, I could have decided to do things a different way. Now, if the decision I'm making is how to add a couple of numbers or how to sort a bunch of characters or how to find a word in a document, you know, it doesn't really matter that much. It's hard for that to be kind of biased. But those kinds of programs are not that interesting. If the program is just implementing basic accounting rules, you know, those are pretty fixed. But when you get into applications that are kind of stepping off into soft decisions, and an example I give in the article is maybe the system is trying to help you identify pictures of good-looking people. Well, you know, geez, you know, suddenly we've just stepped off the edge into an area that is a horribly soft area. But it comes up even in, like, you know, what advertising should I be seeing? Another one that's very interesting right now is a lot of us these days are consuming news online. what news articles am I seeing? We no longer have, you know, a human editor, perhaps with a commitment to the local community, selecting material. What we've got are machines based on algorithms that some developer somewhere wrote, making those decisions and then feeding material to us. Now, I'm not to suggest that the editor was unbiased.
Right.
We kind of believe editors were biased and knew about it. Where we've been blind is that we somehow think that because computers are running in these little electronic boxes, that there's no bias. The point is, oh no, they're littered with bias. And in some ways, the bias is worse.
Well, I'm just reminded a few years ago when it felt like, when I was trying to make certain searches in Google, that they were feeding me completions that they wanted me to go to, and I had to almost go down to the final letter to get the thing, or none at all, the thing that I wanted. I was just like, I wonder who programmed it to kind of feed that as opposed to the thing that I really wanted to see. And then another example you give is Facebook. I guess they were under the microscope, as it were, for a little while and had to meet with folks about the things that they were suggesting were trending or that people would want to see.
Yeah, the Google search patterns, I suspect a lot of that is simply statistically based. I suspect that there's not a lot of necessarily programmed bias in that. The Facebook thing was a little more interesting. There was a human component, but there was also an algorithmic component in that. And, you know, whether you agree or disagree with the folks that raised the issue, there was a concern that they were biasing against certain news outlets and biasing for other news outlets. My concern is not that, hey, I'm supporter of the guy you were biasing against. That's not my point. My point is there's bias and that we just need to be aware of it. And, you know, I tell folks, you know, just because you read it on the internet, it's probably wrong. So we just need to be a lot more discerning, I think, as we approach this. And I think we should hold companies, particularly companies like Facebook that have really an outsized influence. I'm not sure quite how we do that. Almost one of those areas where you wish you had some way of measuring bias because they have such an impact, particularly in a democratic society such as our own. I'm not suggesting that they're trying to make certain things happen. I don't believe that they are. But you can get unintended consequences through these things. And that's where we want to be careful. And that's what I'm advocating. Let's be careful. Let's be careful. Let's keep our eyes open. Let's be intelligent, for Pete's sake.
Exactly. People as big as that, or even upstart folks inventing something new, just being aware that they're biased, that the things they're looking at are biased. I appreciate the fact that you're even saying that. And I hope other folks who maybe haven't heard our conversation will be aware that there's bias everywhere they go. So wrapping this up, what are your recommendations to the AI world? I guess we've already kind of hit on it. And what are you doing next?
I guess my recommendations are, we've kind of danced about those. I don't go to sleep at night worrying about Terminator, I can tell you that. I do worry about autonomous machines, and I worry about them because of the problem that can emerge. And I would like to see rational safeguards put in place on those machines. I believe and advocate for human-computer, you know, interaction with one another. I think that's where it's safest. Certainly machines are more safe when they're in a more constrained, controlled environment than when they're let loose in the wild. So I guess I just want us to be cautious and encourage human-computer interaction. And as far as myself, you know, my day job does not really deal much with artificial intelligence. I work on cloud computing these days.
But you do make comments and you write articles. So, I mean, you're trying to get the word out.
Yeah, I guess my goal is to raise awareness. And I'm actually thinking of writing some more articles because a lot of this field is filled with what I call marketing terms. Deep learning is one of those right now that's out there, and people kind of get all woo-woo over that. But, you know, deep learning, it's a marketing term. If you actually crawl beneath what they mean by deep learning, you're not as impressed. The problem with the terminology that's being used is we import into it much more meaning than it actually can hold. And so part of my goal is to help people see that. I want to kind of demythologize, I guess.
Right.
Computers and AI.
So deep learning, is that something a computer is doing and AI is trying to learn as it goes? Is that what that means?
Well, yes. Really, to put it simplistically and leaving some details out, All it means is that the program has some numerical values that can be tweaked and changed as the machine processes the data it's given. And then there's a couple of forms of how we guide the machine to tweak and change those numerical values. And the minute I say that, you go, wow, that's nothing at all like sitting in a classroom and learning about Roman history. And so we're kind of being disingenuous when we say it's deep learning.
Right.
It's not deep learning. It's a bunch of what we call neural networks that feed into one another, and their numerical values get tweaked and adjusted so that they do a better job identifying something. It's a pattern matching problem. So yeah, I guess I'm trying to, I feel like my job is in Oz. I'm Dorothy walking up to the wizard and pulling the curtain back and going, look, it's just a guy. And that's really what I want to do. I don't want to diminish what they're doing. I just want to make sure we're aware and we don't fall for the magic.
I appreciate that. I think it's been very helpful to me, and hopefully it'll be for a lot of other folks. And I'll spread the word, too, about your articles and your work.
Well, thank you very much, Todd.
Well, Brandon Dixon, I feel like you've helped me breathe a bit of a sigh of relief. Thank you for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking with Brandon Dixon about the limitations of AI. Until next time, I'm Todd Butterfield for ID the Future.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2016. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org or idthefuture.com.